Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
And it does seem like we have a little bit smaller group than usual. And I attribute that to the rain and the Academy Awards. And to perhaps a few hangovers from Saturday night. For those of you who didn't come, we had a wonderful dinner Saturday evening. I think, I'm not sure the exact count, but there were around 150, 140, 150 people there. And we had this huge, huge kind of gymnasium kind of hall that we set up tables with tablecloth and candles and flowers and all these Tibetan flags kind of crisscrossing the ceiling. And 45 people were involved as volunteers to help happen. They could all come together with cooking and setting the tables and buying the food and doing it all. And we had a wonderful meal and a wonderful time, a very joyous time. And for those of you who weren't there, I just might mention that, or also for those of you who were there, that I did feel it was kind of a shift in our new, how we entered into a new phase with our Sangha, with our community. That so many people could come together and we can be so organized as volunteers and just create something so beautiful. And come together in that kind of social way. Very different than the way we usually come together and we come together to practice. It felt like entering a whole new phase of who we are as a community, and it was very joyous. It was hard to get people to stop talking. You know, people love the chance to talk after maybe being in silence so much together. It was very nice. I announced there at the dinner, I mentioned the results of our fundraising efforts that started last fall, but continue to bring in donations ever since. And I thought I might just briefly repeat them here so you all know how we're doing. You know, we're fundraising to get our own building so we can start doing all the different things that really we could be doing now if we had our own place. But we're quite limited by facilities, and we do a lot less than we could in terms of practice opportunities. And so far to date, we've raised $33,000, which to me sounds like a lot of money. And even more phenomenal to me is that that money came from 226 people, and that there are 226 people who support our idea about getting our own center. And to me, it's quite amazing. I didn't know what to expect when we started the fundraising, but I'm kind of quite moved by the number of people offering support. And there is a sheet outside on the table, on the literature table. It looks like this. And this is, for those of you who want to see the breakdown a little bit of how that money came in and where it came from and stuff like that, it's on this sheet of paper here. We need to be creative about how to continue our fundraising because, as I said, it's Saturday night. Even though $33,000 is a phenomenal amount of money for us to have raised, at this rate it'll take us 30 years to get our own place because the property values around here are far from modest. So also this Saturday, Ajahn Tanisaro is a monk and a Buddhist monk and an abbot of a monastery in Southern California. Is coming for the Sati Center to teach a class on the Thai forest tradition of monasticism, the monastic tradition that Jack Kornfield studied in, many people studied in Ajahn Amaro. That was very influential for what the Vipassana movement has become here in the West. Is a theme for that forest tradition, and it's a theme for what he's going to talk about, kind of background his teachings and the practices there. Some of you might be interested. It's a more of a workshop, a class, than it is a retreat, a day long on Saturday at the Sati Center. Probably the brochure is out there for the Sati Center. I'm scheduled to pick him up on Friday when he arrives at the airport around 5 o'clock Friday afternoon. And I'm probably still going to be able to do that. But my personal family life is very much up in the air these days with a sister who's very sick. And I don't know if I can, will be able to make it. And I was wondering if there's any man who's here who would be free on Friday that I could call in case I can't pick him up. in the San Francisco airport to bring him down to Palo Alto. You'll be free Friday afternoon? If you can, at the end, give me your phone number and I'll call you if I need help. Any other announcements? Besha.
At the dinner on Saturday, when you mentioned all the Sangha babies, I realized that a lot of the babies don't have grandparents immediately available. So I decided I'd like to offer myself as a grandma. Grandparents who would like that. And anybody else, and grandpas are important too. So if anyone else is interested, I'll make a list and see that it's available to parents.
Great. There's five either happened or happening babies in our Sangha. There's a 10-month-old named Alexander Beer who came to the dinner on Saturday. And there's kind of an order of when they were born. Then there was my son Torin, who was born in January, and then Eileen Ho, who some of you know, she used to come quite a bit, had a all the babies were 7 pounds, 4 ounces. Apparently. And they're all boys. No, actually, Alexander weighed more. He was a big guy. But Eileen Ho, and then Genevieve Callahan. She comes mostly on Thursdays, but her partner, Joe Metzger, comes mostly on Mondays. And they both haven't been here for a while. And they have their second. The first is Owen, who some of you have met. And then Bonnie Zimmerman is going to have her kid in May scheduled. So that adds up to 5. So you're going to have your hands filled, Pesha. Terry.
We decided tonight in yoga that since next week is the 5th Monday, we were going to have a yoga class. So I wanted to make sure everyone here knew if you would like to come on Monday, we have a yoga at 6:30. It's wonderful if you're here by 6:30, 6:25. You get the last time, you have about 4 times to do everything. So please, all welcome. Normally we do it on the second and fourth.
Chris?
I'm going to be gone for the month of April, and I need somebody to volunteer to take care of the Dhamma and the materials for the month.
The literature that gets put out on the table there, Chris has been carrying back and forth, and someone else is going to do it if it's going to happen, which is a wonderful service. Anybody who's available to do that for that month? Great. You talk to Chris. Okay. So I was sitting here, sitting with you all this evening, and it kind of occurred to me that one of the ways of talking about the meditation practice, meditation is a sitting practice, is more as a metaphor for how to be with life in general, and that what we do when we sit is we sit in the middle of our life. It's one way of understanding it, and that's what we're trying to learn to do for all our life, is to sit in the middle of it, or stand in the middle of it, or to really be in the middle of the life, as opposed to some of the other ways we can be in it. And one of the ways we can be resisting it, putting up our barriers or our resistance or our denials and say no way, holding back. Another way is in which we can be anticipating something in the future, and always looking ahead, planning, or always wondering what's going to happen, trying to make it better. And we can be anxious about things and be lost in our worry. And worry and anxiety to me is kind of like this whirlwind of activity that kind of spins us up and up into our heads and up into nothing. But what we try to do in meditation is very, very simple in a sense, is to sit with some stability in the middle of our life as it is, without necessarily trying to change that, but really to savor it or to feel it or allow it to be there fully in all its diversity, all its variety of ways. So we can really feel our life in a full way. And as you can probably tell, the resistance or the anticipation doesn't really allow us to feel life fully. And of course, part of the reason we resist or anticipate is that our lived life, as life is lived in the present moment, isn't necessarily always so pleasant. It's not always so easy. It can be painful. But one of the things we're doing in meditation is very simple. We learn how to sit in the middle of it and have some stability and some willingness to feel our life, to sit in the middle of our life as it is and discover what life is by living in the middle of it rather than living in, behind it or in front of it. And our life changes a lot. A lot of changing opportunities, lots of changing experiences, a lot of changing context where we sit in. There's times when we sit, there's a lot of joy and happiness. And I think some people who come to a group like this come to a group to be inspired, to find some hope in their life, and in subtle ways, maybe kind of to lean forward, anticipating something really good or something good, you know, wonderful. But rather, to kind of back off and sit down in the middle of our life is really what this practice is about. And I think a group like this is really a place to come to find support in sitting in the middle of our life, not in anticipating some great or feeling inspired by some great spiritual possibility which is out there. So we sit, and there's a whole variety of things in this room tonight. Just tremendous diversity of things happening. All of us come with our own things and backgrounds from the day and feelings and things going on in our life. So sometimes we sit with great joy. Some of you might be sitting with happiness and content to be here. Sometimes we sit with great sorrow and great despair. Sometimes we sit and we get quite concentrated, and there can be great ecstasy and delight in the meditation practice itself. And other times there's tremendous restlessness and anxiety as we sit here. And all these things kind of change. And the point always is not the context, not to change the context so much, but to really learn how to sit in the middle of our life as it is. And it's kind of a paradox, because most of our life, many people, we live our life kind of in monkey mind, a mind that's always anticipating, always resistant, always anxious and worry, and a very busy mind. Especially people come and sit at the end of a busy day. It's such a relief to come and sit and let this busy mind kind of get a little bit of a rest. So we have this instable mind oftentimes, and we, in learning to sit in the middle of whatever is happening, the paradox in a sense is we start becoming stable. The body becomes stable and settled. And as the body becomes stable and settled in the midst of our life as it is, then it gives a chance of the mind, the busy mind, to also take a rest, take a break, and settles itself, and it gets calm also, it gets quiet. And then as we get more stable and settled in our life as it is right now, in all its variety of ways, then the world of impermanence, of change, opens up in a new way. And we see that things are actually changing much more rapidly in our life and our ways in which we experience the world than we anticipated or we realized when we were constantly in that monkey mind. And it's taught in Buddhism that the world of impermanence is often obscured by people, by us, by our illusion, our delusion of permanence. The mind itself, our thoughts themselves, often relate to the world through concepts, through ideas. And we impose and lay ideas and concepts on top of our experience. And then we relate to the concepts as if they have some real stability. Not realizing they're just concepts and are quite ephemeral. I don't know if this quite relates, but there's a famous quote of Munindra, a teacher in England, in India, who said, the thought of your mother is not your mother. And your mother is different than what your mother is different than, you know, this concept of what a mother is, or your particular mother is. And in other times, she's, you know, maybe she's a wife, or she's a daughter of someone else, or she's many different roles, but the roles are just concepts. And to always kind of fixate on the concept and not the real reality gives the illusion sometimes of permanence when permanence is not really there. And that kind of approach is found in many different areas of our life. We relate to things as if they're permanent. So our emotional life, sometimes we feel great despair or great upset or great something. And all of us, you know, if you're asked, you know, is this going to be forever? And you say, no, it's not going to be forever. We know it's going to change. But in the middle of living our difficult emotions, oftentimes we don't realize that they're going to change. And we relate to them as if they're permanent, as if they're, you know, oh my God, I'm going to be depressed forever. I think that's true for a lot of people. And the illusion of permanence creates a great burden for many people, kind of weighs us down, doesn't allow us to kind of float on the surface of all the shifting waves. So maybe I shouldn't change metaphors, but anyway, to sit in the middle of our life like a cork on the floating on the waves. I'm sorry. So on Saturday, I did a one-day retreat at Spirit Rock on the theme of impermanence. So it's been on my mind. since then and before that. And I left the retreat up at Spirit Rock and came down to our wonderful dinner. And it was a celebratory event. It was really wonderful. And I walked in this huge, festive dining hall had been created where there hadn't been one before. Just manifested itself out of many people's efforts. And the event was quite marvelous, but in terms of impermanence, it struck me quite strongly how quickly at the end we dissembled it. Because part of the evening was everybody was supposed to stay and help with, for about 15 minutes we did maybe, of this collective cleaning. And we all kind of scampered around like ants and did all these different stuff to put it all away. And all the tables and chairs and candles and tablecloths and foods and banners and everything just vanished into the just impermanent. It passed also. And it struck me how quickly we were able to do that. And then if I'd known how quickly we were going to do it, maybe we could have lingered a little bit longer. Because we were supposed to be out of there by 10. And as it was, we were all done, finished with it all by 9:30. But it was nice, we had the impermanence of it all, seeing all that and how this wonderful thing just kind of dissolved into the walls or wherever impermanence goes. And then I went home and came home around 11 o'clock and I learned that my sister, who had been sick last week, and my sister is a very delicate health, that on Saturday hadn't answered the phone or returned any phone calls, which is not a good sign. She lives alone, and because she'd been bedridden most of the week. So I got home, and at 11:30 I jumped in my car and drive over to the East Bay, up to El Cerrito where she lives, and not knowing, driving all the way up there, sitting in the middle of my life. But the middle of my life at that moment was quite a bit anticipating what I was going to find when I came into her house, hoping I had the right key for her house to get in, wondering what am I going to find there. And I don't know if there was kind of anticipatory thinking. I wasn't just simply driving, but that's what my life was like at that moment. So I sat in the middle of that kind of thought. And I don't know if it should have been any different. You're going to someone who's maybe seriously sick, and how do you take care of it the best? And I think certain consideration is part of all that. And I arrived there, and she was in very bad shape. I got there about 12:30, and she has a kidney transplant. So her health, there's a lot of delicate issues around her health because of that. And it turned out that she'd managed to get herself very dehydrated, which is very bad for a kidney. And I found her there, and she had this very dazed look on her eyes, and could hardly talk. Ask her questions. She had to kind of ask the questions repeatedly, and she's kind of eyes would kind of roll to the ceiling, and she kind of would answer sometimes. And it was quite dramatic. Her lips were not just simply parched, they were cracked and bloody and pussy. And her tongue also the same way, from being dehydrated. It was quite painful to see. So that's what life was about. So we sit in the middle of that. And to think that I wasn't supposed to be sitting in the middle of that, to think that I was supposed to be somewhere else, or feeling great, boundless joy, it's not what life is about. Life is about just sitting in the middle of what arrives, what's here. So I had this great joyous event early in the evening. We sat in the middle of that. And then later at night, I sat in the middle of all this anticipatory fear. And then I sat in the middle of actually finding my sister there quite ill. So I called the 911, and the ambulance and the fire department came. And we took her to the hospital, and it looks like it's pretty bad for her. It looks like maybe her kidneys failed again, and some virus has kicked in that they don't know what it is. And so she's laying there in the hospital, and at this point we don't know what the story is. So we sit in the middle of that, So I'm sitting in the middle of that, and my mood, you probably feel my mood's a little bit different today than maybe usual. And my mood, is very much influenced there by the events of my sister and what's going on up there. And so I sit in the middle of that. And so I feel, even though I can sit with some stability in the midst of that, around me is this very strong kind of feeling of concern, of a kind of heaviness, a kind of sadness, a kind of... And I don't know if it should be any different than that. I don't know if anything should be any different, but what we can always offer ourselves, and I think what the practice offers, is the opportunity, the ability to always kind of learn how to sit in the middle. And that's, you know, that's the one thing maybe that's somewhat permanent or somewhat more constant in our life, for those of us who practice, is what's constant is our willingness, our commitment to bring ourselves and to sit in the middle of our changing life and to feel it all as it changes, to sit ourselves in the middle of it and to come back, be willing to come back. And we train ourselves, I think it's a tremendous training to sit in meditation and to do that in a regular way, to do it every day, because it's not easy to remember to sit in the middle of our life. It's very easy to get to, I mean, it would have been very easy for me to sit here this evening and have my mind spinning off about, you know, all kinds of thoughts around my sister and fears and I wasn't denying the experience. I was sitting in the midst of it quite fully, but I was really feeling it kind of with my whole body, the experience of what's going on for me. And there was a stability, tremendous stability I felt in the midst of all that. And I know what it would have been like to have been unstable in the midst of that. And being unstable is kind of what is instability, which practice kind of counteracts. Instability of mind, so we can live in an unstable world, a world of constant change, with the stability of offering ourselves the opportunity to come back over and over again to sit in the middle of our life. And what is our life? And our life is different from day to day, completely different. And part of what we're trying to learn then is the flexibility to sit with life as it's actually lived, as it actually happens, as it changes from day to day, from hour to hour, from minute to minute. To really sit in the middle of that and not to linger so much in the past and not to anticipate so much in the future, not to hold up resistance, not to push away. So the world of impermanence, the world of change, is one of the primary, fundamental insights and teachings of the whole Buddhist tradition. In some ways, you could say that one of the cornerstones of Buddhism is a tremendous appreciation and willingness to explore and understand the experiences of impermanence, how things change, arise, and pass. And the formula in Buddhism, the dogmatic formula for impermanence, is the expression, all composite things, all fabricated things, are impermanent. Anything that comes together and is born will at some point pass away. And to realize that, and to see that realistically, is considered in Buddhism to be offer a door to freedom in the middle of our life. To have some freedom, perhaps always to be able to come back and sit in the middle of our life. To always come back and really sit in the middle of whatever is happening. That's considered to be a freedom. And the freedom to that is through one of the doors to that is to really have a deep appreciation for impermanence, for the fact that things do change. And we do know that things changed. I mean, it's not Buddhism doesn't have a monopoly on that particular truth. You know, most cultures and most religions will point to impermanence at some point or other. And perhaps what's unique about Buddhism is its thorough appreciation, exploration of the theme of impermanence. And I thought I would just mention a little bit three layers or three not layers. Maybe it's not a good word, but three. I don't know what the right categories are. Three aspects or three ways of seeing impermanence depending on the level of your perception of it. The ordinary perception, the ordinary level, is the kind of impermanence that most cultures and people we all kind of see. We see impermanence mostly around us quite a bit. Heraclitus said you can't step in the same river twice. And you know, people live, people die. It's, you know, we're all going to die sooner or later, and we can say simple things like cliches, like even the mountains will wear down, disappear with time. All things are going to pass away. Nothing's really permanent. In Buddhism, they say the only permanent thing is the truth that nothing is permanent. Concepts can be permanent, and that's a concept. But the actual phenomena itself that we experience and relate to in the world, the composite elements of the world, are constantly in change. And to resist that change too much, or not to understand or see that change deeply, limits our ability to live in the life wisely, live in the world wisely. And sometimes pointing to impermanence is not always a polite thing to do. For example, when Joseph Goldstein, who's a famous Vipassana teacher in this country. He doesn't particularly care to officiate weddings. But he told me the first wedding he officiated, he gave a Dharma talk on death. And so maybe, I don't know if he was trying to, you know, why, what wisdom was behind that, whether he was trying to, what? He was trying not to have to do too many more weddings. But it is something, you know, to marriage or to be in any relationship at all, to be for permanent partnership or something, it's supposed to last to the end of life. Built into that commitment to stay with someone till the end of life is built into that is, unless the rare opportunity or situation that both people die at the same time, one of the people is going to die before the other. And that's kind of part of the deal, right? So we don't usually mention that when people are getting married. By the way, one of you is going to die first. But that's part and parcel of what comes together when we form that kind of commitment. One person is going to die. And so the world of impermanence is built into that. And I think it's helpful, I think, to have some appreciation that things do change and that we can't always expect things to stay the same. Things change dramatically fast sometimes for some people. Just like that. Our life can be turned upside down. My sister was fine a week ago. And I don't know if she'll be alive next week. People die faster than that. The automobile accident I saw in 280 some time ago. I drove by maybe a minute or two after the accident. And the car was upside down. The car was pancaked. I can't imagine that the person inside was alive, just because, and that happened just like that. I can't, you know, probably, you know, 1 minute that they were driving down the road and happy and talking, listening to the radio or whatever they do, and the next minute they were no longer alive. It happens that quickly. Impermanence happens very, very quickly, and there's no guarantee for any of us that we go home tonight, our houses are going to be there. We don't know what's going to happen anywhere we go. Last night, yesterday I was driving home from the hospital, and I was I live up in Skyline, and I was driving south from 92, and there's all chaparral up in the mountains there, and there was a brush fire. A power line had fallen, there was, you know, smoking and brush firing, so I pulled over and went to a call box and called and reported the fire and stood there until the fire truck came. You know, these things, another little example of things don't last. Things are impermanent. We don't know when a fire is going to come. When's a fire going to start 5 miles further south where my house is, and I'm going to go home and not find my house there. To always expect that things we set up and create for our life are always going to be the same and never change is a recipe for suffering. We don't know. And so to have some realistic sense of the possibility of things will pass away, I think allows us to be a little more at ease in our life as it is. Not a lot. It doesn't mean that we become pain-free, but some. So the ordinary level of impermanence, the ordinary that we see all the time and recognize, it doesn't only represent the possibility of loss. It also represents the possibility of change, and of development, of new things happening. It's tremendous potential. If things are always the same, there'd be no potential for growth and development. And so because of change and impermanence, there's also the possibility of change and development. And so part of what the practice involves is recognizing it's possible to develop more stability. It's possible to become kinder. It's possible to become more compassionate. It's possible to become more mindful. And so as we sit, it's possible to become a richer, more diverse, active sangha community, like we're developing here, seemingly here in Palo Alto. And things develop and change, so at least temporarily, for the better. And part of what we can do is, in appreciating that, is we could shepherd that and kind of encourage it, and kind of encourage things to change and develop in a good direction, or helpful or wholesome directions. But it's best not to be dependent on those changes or expect that those changes are always going to be here. Things can change quite radically, and it's all over, like that dinner. You know, we had a wonderful dinner we created, and then in 15 minutes it was dissolved. The wonderful sangha that we have here in Palo Alto could probably dissolve relatively quickly I don't know what it would take. Maybe if this building kind of was sold or burned down, what would we do? We'd find another one, I guess, and we'd continue. But I could see it, you know, something happened. What happened if I had a major sex scandal in the community? You know, you know, that would change things quickly. Or if I disappeared with the $33,000. So, and then this sangha disappears. So this is the kind of the ordinary level, and the ordinary level has part of it, you know, the elements of loss, part of it the elements of gain and development. Part of it has this wonderful, huge, pregnant arena of potential, of possibility. And kind of to appreciate the great potential of the next moment, of the next, you know, day. We don't know what's going to happen. It's an infinite number of potentials. Nothing's really committed until it happens. And there's a tremendous amount of stuff can happen. Sometimes when I've said this before, but sometimes I feel like the present moment is like this amazing thing. It's, you know, it's, I don't know if you realize how totally amazing the present moment is. We tend to live in concepts and ideas and even of time, which really keeps us from really appreciating the present moment. But the present moment is eternal. And the present moment is very democratic, egalitarian. Egalitarian is maybe a better word. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. Everybody has equal allotment of the present moment. And the present moment is always here for everyone equally, for us all to tap into and live into. And they often, sometimes the expression in Buddhism, the eternal present. The present never changes, it's always eternal. And you can kind of a luxury, it's considered one of the great luxuries of life, is to rest in what's always here for all of us, the eternal present. To get a sense of that, to feel that. But in addition, there is, you know, if you get into concepts a little bit, the idea that there is a future, something's going to happen, we're stepping into the future. Each moment we're stepping into the unknown in the future. And the image I have is the image of the present moment is like a cliff, and we're standing at the edge of this cliff. And what life is asking us to do is to step off that cliff. Because we have to go ahead, right? We can't go backwards. We have to go ahead because behind us is another cliff. The past. That's the big abyss that everything goes into, right? It all falls into, right? The memories of what you ate today, and who you talked to today, and the people you knew today, and all the presidents of the United States who have passed away have gone in there, and all the pharaohs have gone to the same place, and all the pyramids have gone to the same. Everything's gone to this big abyss behind us, right? And there's this big abyss in front of us of the future, and we're asked to step into it. But you know, it's this, you know, great chasm. You know, who wants to step into this big unknown? It's just, you know, it's like empty, but oh, it's kind of dumb, isn't it? So anyway, we have to do it. There's no choice. It happens anyway, whether we do it or not. We step into that great abyss, and then magically, what happens is the cliff grows out and receives the step, and then we have to make the next step into the great emptiness, and then the cliff grows out and takes our step. That's somehow the way I see the present moment or our life. There's tremendous potential unknown about what we're going to step into.
Like stepping off the
100-foot pole they talk about in Zen. So ordinary impermanence, you know, see, has full of loss, full of possibility, full of change and growth and gain also. The next level of impermanence has to do with, is the level of impermanence which is recognized as an insight in Vipassana practice. Vipassana practice is, you know, sometimes translated as insight practice, and in particular, one of the particular insights that makes it an insight practice is not, it's not, you know, psychological insight into the workings of your mind and your history and, you know, your relationship with your parents and all that. It's rather insight into what's considered to be universal characteristics of all our experiences, and impermanence is considered to be one of them. And to really see deeply the impermanence of the ways in which we experience our life is considered to be a very profound insight that comes from this practice. The ability to put ourselves and sit ourselves in the middle of our life is the beginning. And once we place ourselves in the middle of our life and experience our life as it is, then there's with that stability, we tend to try to study, investigate, discover more intimately what this present moment lived life is like. As our concentration and mindfulness gets stronger and stronger in the practice itself, the practice opens up to a very dramatic experience of the rising and passing of phenomena, rising and passing of whatever we can experience. And part of this is that most of us live in concepts. And when the mind becomes quiet and still enough and concentrated enough, we don't live in the concepts anymore, but we start living more directly in what can be experienced directly in life. The building blocks of life, actually lived life, experienced life, the perceptive life, what we perceive, upon which we build the cathedrals and edifices of our concepts of reality or self or society. But as the concepts begin quieting down, we can actually begin feeling and experiencing directly the perceptual level of things that are the building blocks for this abstract world we tend to live in. And when we start seeing that in deep vipassana practice, we start seeing that it arises and passes very quickly. That the building blocks for all these concepts is actually constantly shifting impermanence, constantly shifting change. And that's considered to be a very important insight. It's not a belief. It's not something you talk yourself into. But rather, it's something that you see very directly as a result of a concentrated meditation practice. Sometimes it's quite frightening for people. It's more frightening for some people to see impermanence at this kind of cellular level than it is to see the impermanence of, you know, of kind of the ordinary impermanence we see around us all the time. But as the mindfulness practice continues, one of the values that this level of insight, or this level of meditation practice has, is we learn or see that if everything is always, in our experience, is always arising and passing, that it's not possible to grasp onto anything, not possible to cling to anything. And in Buddhism, clinging is considered to be a source of suffering. And the freedom from that kind of suffering is the freedom from clinging to things anymore. And as we experience in our meditation practice the arising and passing of phenomena, and we no longer realize it's not actually possible to cling to things when things are passing so quickly, we slowly begin to not hold on, not to cling to things anymore. And we have an experience of being alive, sitting in the middle of our life, where there's no movement towards clinging, no movement towards holding on to anything at all, no movement toward resisting anything at all, which is a kind of clinging or pushing anything away. And I characterize that kind of experience as an experience of tremendously deep, pervasive trust. We allow the heart, the mind, to be alive in life, in our experience of life, but with enough confidence, enough trust, that we can just be there open-handed, open-heartedly, open-mindedly, without any clinging or holding towards anything. And the value of this very deep vipassana insight is not that it teaches us anything about the world particularly, but that the main value is that it teaches us, it gives us a taste for what is possible, a taste of a mind which is so open that it doesn't cling to anything, doesn't hold on to anything. And when we start getting that taste of that possibility, then we start relating to the normal life that we live very differently. And we start understanding much better what practice is really about. It's said that we don't only understand deeply for the first time what Buddhist practice is really about when we really see the possibility of having a mind or heart which in no way at all holds or clings to anything at all. Doesn't resist anything, doesn't fear anything, but can stay there receptively open to whatever arises and passes in an experience. To have a taste of that possibility of mind opens a whole new vista for how to live a life. And as it becomes more stable, that ability to rest there and that tremendous trust of mind, then there's a dramatic new vision that arises that becomes almost transformative for people when the last little remnant of clinging is finally released. And perhaps one of the last remnants of clinging that is most subtle and most difficult, and we can't really release it releases itself, is the clinging to consciousness itself, to awareness itself, and to let go even of awareness and let the mind be so trusting and so open so even awareness is kind of floats away like a bird kind of released from your hand, transforms the core of much of who we are. So there's three levels of impermanence. There's the ordinary level. There's a level of impermanence that that arises out of very deep vipassana practice, which is tremendously informative because it teaches us a very different way of being. It's very hard to discover in ordinary life. And then when that's done very, very thoroughly, it opens to the third level of impermanence. It's when impermanence is the door for this total release of all the remnants of holding. That kind of changes the core in the sense of who we are. But we sit in the middle of our life. And so even if that happens, even if we've been transformed, it still hurts when people are sick and when they die. And so we sit in the middle of that. And it doesn't have to be different. And we act accordingly. So those are my thoughts for today. Does anyone have... We have a couple of minutes before the end. Does anyone have any comments or questions about impermanence? Yes?
I'm confused about the part where you're saying that our heart is... doesn't have to cling, and yet there's some sorrow around having a family member that's ill, and so I'm not sure how that works.
Well, this is my, you know, what I've been able to understand of life so far. So I take it just as my, you know, what I've figured out or what I've experienced. I don't think that the Buddhist practice is a cure for all pain. If you stub your toe, you're going to hurt. If someone that you love dies, you're going to feel some pain. The Buddha said had a bad back that hurt him. The Buddha said felt grief when people in his home country were massacred when it was conquered by a neighboring country. But he felt some grief, felt some pain there. That's part of life, I think, to have, you know, there's often pain with loss, pain with physical pain, illness and all that. The freedom from suffering that Buddhism talks about is the freedom from, it wants to define suffering a little bit different than that kind of pain. Suffering is the kind of pain that arises because we cling to things or want things to be different or resist change. So my sister can be sick and I can feel the pain of that and some sorrow from that in a sense. But I could feel a lot more. I could feel guilty. I could feel anxious. I could feel full of fear and worry about the future. I could feel, you know, there's a lot of extra stuff I can burden that experience with. It's the burdening of the simplicity of life with things which are unnecessary to burden it with, which is the point of Buddhist practice. We burden life a tremendous amount of extra suffering through our attachments, our clingings, our fears. Grief is a great example. If someone passes and dies, I think it's normal to feel some grief, someone we're very close to. Buddhist practice helps us to sit in the middle of that grief, just to sit in the middle of that, as opposed to resisting it, saying, no, I'm not going to feel it, shutting down against it, or as opposed to having all kinds of reactions to what it means. Feeling anger towards a person who died, or anger towards oneself for not having done much, or feeling embarrassed by having all this grief. After all, people around me are telling me that after 6 months I've grieved long enough, and we feel embarrassed, we feel awkward. There's a lot of extra stuff that happens around it. And what we want, what we're trying to find in Buddhism practice, I believe, is clean grief, clean sorrow, clean physical pain. And when it's clean, then I think we're much more willing and at ease of feeling it while it's happening. We have much more grace in the middle of it. But there's no suffering, because Buddhists define suffering kind of funny. There's pain, but there's no suffering that arises out of resistance or clinging. Now, that's kind of maybe disappointing to some of you, because you thought maybe Buddhist practice was to a happy ever after kind of story. Now, isn't it wonderful, all these wonderful fairy tales where the couple meet and the fairy tale ends and they lived happily ever after, as if one of them wasn't the first one to die? You know, there's more to what happens in living happily ever after.
That's when things begin.
That's when things begin. That's a very good point. That's when things begin. So I hope that I hope this talk was useful. But I hope that you discover the value and discover appreciation for the possibility of just sitting in the middle of your life, both literally in the meditation practice, but also metaphorically, that to learn what it is to sit in the middle of your life without, so you experience it fully for what it is, without all the extra stuff we burden onto it. So thank you all, and I wish you all well, and may you all sit well. Oh, I keep forgetting, even with a reminder here in front of me. There's a beautiful tradition in our Theravada tradition of Buddhism of publishing books on the Dharma for free and then distributing them freely. And Ajahn Amaro came to Palo Alto a couple of weeks ago and did this wonderful weekend of teaching. And he brought all these free books. And there are books and free pamphlets and stuff out there on the table. And they're quite marvelous, Dharma books and teachings. And those of you who would like to receive, be part of this wonderful flow of freely given Dharma activities, can pick up one of the books and newsletters and enjoy them. Thank you.